We're going to open the Senate Rural Communities and Economic Development Committee. We have two bills, House Bill 4029A and 4142A, both for work sessions today. We are not going to hear 4142A, so that one, if you're here for that one, it's not going to happen today. And so we are going to open a work session on House Bill 4029A. You want to give a short explanation of the bill, and then we'll have a motion by my, since my vice chair's not here, my other member.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4029A would authorize the owner of a tract of land to withdraw from a city if the city's located within Metro and was incorporated between January 1, 2000 and January 1, 2005. There is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue.
Okay.
If the staff person could just explain the A4 amendment and what some of the testimony on that has been.
Mr. Chair, members, the A4 amendment was put forward to specify a different operative date for the act, so it would have depended on whether a comprehensive plan and regulations were adopted, approved, and acknowledged by various entities by specified dates in the amendment.
Okay, thank you. So a motion.
Okay. Ms. Chair Roblin, I move House Bill 4029A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Close moves House Bill 4029A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any opposition? Seeing none. The motion passes. I will carry the bill on the floor. And we will close our work session on House Bill 4029A. And we will probably give Senator a chance to vote on it when she has a chance, when she gets back.
Okay.
If you want to make that motion to suspend the rules. Thank you. With that, we're going to open up a public hearing on or an informational meeting on the impacts of the Pole Creek wildfire on fish and wildlife and the aquatic habitat and on the public health. We'll open that hearing and we'll bring up our whoever you want to bring with you, Doug. So thank you. And we appreciate you being here and the request that was made through legislation to get all the stuff. I really do appreciate having you here tonight today. So thank you.
Good. Thanks. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Beth. My name is Doug Decker. I serve as Oregon State Forester and the Director of the Oregon Department of Forestry. I'm pleased to be here with this team who will be joining us up here in a moment to fulfill a request from the 2013 session related to House Bill 3109 and the Pole Creek Fire. Pole Creek Fire burned about 26,000 acres outside of Sisters, all on national forest land in 2012. The fire, you may remember, the Pole Creek Fire was in the news for a bunch of reasons. It burned, very intensely. There was some intense fire behavior based on the flammable fuel types that were involved. But the thing that folks will remember certainly about Pole Creek was the smoke and the smoke impacts and the air quality impacts around Sisters. Really was, had some serious public health impacts that resulted in some folks leaving town for weeks. Really, the impetus for taking on the work that we're here to share with you today was a result of collaboration between Representative Gene Wisnant and Representative Brad Witt, who recognized the long-term impacts of fire and really asked us to take a deeper look at how fire affects public health and fish and wildlife habitat. And so the presentation you're about to receive here is the story of that inquiry into those topics. As you hear from our forest and fire and forest scientists and our public health experts here this afternoon, I ask you to listen for the common theme. Bless you. Which is that the common theme is that fundamental shifts in forest management policy and in federal budget and capacity are really producing an unhealthy, undesirable suite of consequences that are increasingly characterizing large fires in Oregon, particularly on federal land. We have more large fires that are resulting from greater buildups of unhealthy forest conditions. And It's not simply enough to look just at the financial costs of fire, and we've seen that this last session, this last season, with one of the most costly fire seasons we've ever experienced. But we have to look deeper as well at the basic impacts to human health and to air quality and to fish and wildlife habitat, and really even the underlying productivity of the soil to understand the true toll of large fires in Oregon. I think you're going to find the material that we're going to present here thought-provoking and relevant to our current work on influencing federal forest management and fire policy, as well as to future work that we can do there as well. So I'm pleased to introduce Nancy Hirsch, who's ODF's Chief of Fire, who's going to introduce our panel and get us moving here.
Thank you, Doug. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Hirsch, Fire Protection Division Chief for Oregon Department of Forestry. This is obviously going to be a joint presentation with Oregon Health Authority as directed by House Bill 3109. And it really is the purpose of this bill was to study public health and forest effects of the 26,000-acre Pole Creek fire. The primary purpose is all about seeking to increase public awareness of the effects. And we appreciate having had this opportunity really to work not only with our counterparts at Oregon Health Authority, but a number of other state agencies, as well as with Representative Witt and Wisnett. To my right is Curtis Coode. He's the Environmental Public Health Section Manager, and also available here with us in the room is Dave Ferrer, Public Health Toxicologist. Curtis will present the OHA report on the impacts to the public, as well as the associated recommendations. Teresa Alcock is just two down from me. She is the Department of Forestry's Fire Program Analyst and will present the impacts on forests and streams. And I will wrap up with the recommendations. To start with, we wanted to provide a little bit of context and kind of set the stage for where the Pole Creek fire was at. You can see right here is the town of Sisters. Many of you have taken this trip up and over the San Anne Pass through the B&B fire. And obviously here, this is the footprint of the Pole Creek fire, which was 100% on the Deschutes National Forest Sisters Ranger District. These different colors represent different types of ownership within the Forest Service. So essentially, it's all Forest Service managed. But you have delineated here late successional reserves, as well as this area in this color represents wilderness area. Also to note on this map is the Sisters Community Wildfire Protection Plan boundary. And you can see also the private land here to the north in these checkerboard right here, as well as this large block. There are also several streams in the watershed, including the Pole Creek, for which the fire was named. So a few facts. The bottom line metrics here are on the screen for you associated with the Pole Creek fire. For me, I think it sums up by stating it was a devastating large fire, all within the Wychus watershed, which was burned severely. And the photo here shows that devastation. This resulted in 26% of the fire area being susceptible to moderate to high soil erosion. In order to put the impacts into context, it may be helpful to review recent fire history. There have been several large fires in this vicinity over the past decade, resulting in almost 200,000 acres being burned on U.S. Forest Service land here, specifically within the Sisters Ranger District. Like others, the Pole Creek fire spread rapidly in contiguous accumulated fuels. The result was a hotter and more intense fire that even killed thinned and normally fire-resilient stands of ponderosa pine. The picture on the left depicts such a stand in the Pole Creek burn area that was treated and still burned due to the intensity of the fire coming off adjacent untreated stands. So with that, we'll shift gears and move right into Oregon Health Authority presenting the impacts on public health.
Thank you, Nancy. And for the record, Chair Roblin and members of the committee, I'm Curtis Coode. I'm the Interim Section Manager for Environmental Public Health in the Oregon Health Authority. So considering impacts to public health, Oregon Health Authority found no reported direct injuries from the fire. Those injuries would have included burns, inhalation of superheated gases, carbon monoxide poisoning, et cetera. However, the particulate or PM2.5 component of wildfire smoke is the most hazardous to health to the general public, including sensitive populations. PM2.5 is associated with increased cardiac events, including fatal events, in people with pre-existing heart conditions and exacerbations of pre-existing respiratory illnesses like asthma. Sisters experienced several days of PM2.5 in the hazardous range during the Pole Creek fire. You can see that on the chart in the dark red area on the top. In Bend, PM2.5 only hit unhealthy for sensitive groups a couple of days and was in the moderate to good range throughout the rest of the fire period. You can see as you go down the chart, you go through unhealthy to moderate and et cetera. OHA observed no difference in the number of heart-related or respiratory-related hospitalizations during the Pole Creek fire compared to the same time the previous year when there was no fire. However, hospitalizations is a somewhat crude measure because it only includes people who were admitted to the hospital. People who go to the emergency room or immediate care or regular doctor's appointments and receive treatment and go home are not captured in this particular measure. Emergency rooms and immediate care facilities are not required to report smoke-related illnesses to Oregon Health Authority. OHA asked emergency rooms and immediate care facilities to provide data voluntarily. One facility provided data for all of the days that we requested for this report. One facility provided data for some of the days, and one facility provided data for only one of the days. And the rest of the facilities in the area did not report data. So while the data that we have are limited, they did not suggest an increase in heart-related or respiratory-related emergency room or immediate care visits. We'll return to that later. Thanks. This table shows the numbers of deaths related to cardiac events and respiratory events in Deschutes County. And we're comparing 2011 and 2012, as well as the time periods before, during, and after the Pole Creek fire. So you'll note the column in the middle is the period of the Pole Creek fire for both 2011 and 2012. There are more deaths related to both heart and respiratory conditions in 2012 than in 2011, during that period of the fire. However, the time period prior to the start of the Pole Creek fire in 2012 saw just as many heart-related deaths as during the fire. So no significant difference there. Even though there appears to be an increase in deaths related to respiratory ailments in Deschutes County during the Pole Creek fire compared to 2011 and time periods before and after the fire in 2012, only one of those 14 deaths was a person living in Sisters, and that was the area hardest hit by the PM2.5. The other 13 respiratory-related deaths in Deschutes County during the period of the fire in 2012 represent people who live 20 or more miles away from Sisters. The only other air quality monitor in Deschutes County at the time was in Bend, where the air quality was much better than in Sisters. Next slide, please. Two smoke-related motor vehicle crashes occurred in the Sisters area during the Pole Creek wildfire. And we know this because ODOT's accident reporting forms has an option for the reporter of an accident to indicate whether the accident was related to decreased visibility due to smoke. No injuries were reported in connection with these two accidents. So with that.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Teresa Alcock. I'm the fire program analyst for the Oregon Department of Forestry. So we're going to move over to the fish and wildlife impacts now. And I wanted to put the wildlife impacts into a context as well. What we see on screen is a map of fire severity. Behind that, the primary colors we see are what we call fire regimes. And fire regimes are a way to characterize the type of fire that we might encounter in an area such as Pole Creek. And it's based on the topography, the climate, and the impact fire would have on the primary vegetation in the area. And so what we're looking at here is basically fire severity. And we've got families of colors. Generally, the darker the color, the more severe the fire burned. Now, in terms of wildlife impacts, the high severity fires modify the habitat the most, where substantial forest canopy and ground cover is removed. We call those stand replacement fires. And there's a family of red colors, and the darker the red, the more severe. But this area up here in the northeast of the fire was a low severity area historically, so we shouldn't see so much of the dark red. So what we're looking at is that the fire burned pretty severely where it normally wouldn't have if the area wasn't experiencing the current conditions of that fire. So with the Pole Creek fire, we have different burn severities across the landscape, and that has variable impacts on fish and wildlife. But we want to emphasize that 39% of the burn area was high severity and considered stand replacement. The map up on screen now shows that same fire severity, but we've got streams highlighted in the purple colors. And those streams are from our recent project called the Westwide Wildfire Risk Assessment, where the Council of Western States Foresters and Oregon Department of Forestry had analyzed 17 states in the West to find out what the fire risk is. So there's a number of variables that were used in the modeling process and so forth. Experts in hydrography and hydrology, fire ecologists from every state participated in this project, and we have an extensive data set for the state of Oregon. So we see that, according to the map, there are several sensitive streams in the area that were burned very severely by the Pole Creek fire. So some impacts to wildlife are beneficial, and some are detrimental. Severe forest stand replacement fires reduce habitat for species that require canopy cover and benefit species that require open areas. So those species adapt to survive their historic fire regime, or what they've adapted to over time. Abrupt habitat changes from a disturbance such as wildfire will influence the wildlife, and you'll see movements in communities to find alternative sources of canopy cover and forage. To the next one. So among the greatest impacts, you remember the first map we saw that gave us a geography of the area. There were some late successional reserves marked in dark green, and we lost some of that habitat. And although the spotted owl has marginal habitat in this area, it is noted in this area. So we lost some of the older interior forest habitat and the connectivity among those habitats. But we have an increase in open canopy habitats, which are going to benefit big game. The mule deer out there and the elk thrive in open environments for their forage needs. With the loss of forest canopy, there is a potential for reduced precipitation reception and earlier snowpack melting. And so obviously when you remove the live trees, you're not going to have anything to receive that precipitation and keep the moisture in the forest. It's going to be important the next fire season comes around in terms of what we call live fuel moistures. We want to keep the trees that are there green and good moisture content. So 26% of the fire area is susceptible to a moderate to high soil erosion hazard. And we're going to see some potential of a lot of erosion and sedimentation in the streams. 35% of the riparian reserves, which is another designation by the Forest Service, 35% of those streamside areas had high to moderate soil burn severity. and that's going to have an impact on the primary food web species. Macroinvertebrates and the smaller species that live in the soil and along the stream sides aren't as mobile as some of the larger big game that can escape the fire. So we'll see some mortality there. Soil burn and loss of soil cover impacts a primary food web species. With standing dead snags, raptors and woodpeckers are going to benefit, the cavity nesters and those feeding on the insects. There's going to be a surge in the insect population. In terms of the fish, there was no direct fish mortality observed, but the fire burned the headwaters of several sensitive streams in the area, and it also impacted sensitive forests. There's going to be an increase in stream temperatures when you remove the canopy of the forest along the stream sides. Obviously, you're going to have more sunlight hitting the stream, which is going to raise the temperature. And you're also going to see an increase in the primary productivity of that stream. You're going to see some algal growth and things like that. It's going to change the chemistry of the stream water. We're going to see some ash flows, erosion, washouts. We saw a picture of Pole Creek Spring that was black and white, severely eroded, and lots of flooding, lots of flushing through of the system. This might impact the fish reds or the nests that the steelhead and trout are going to be using in those streams. We're going to see the degradation of the water quality with those increased sediments from erosion and, as I said earlier, the chemical changes. So the Forest Service will continue monitoring after this fire, and we may expect to see these kinds of impacts that they're going to be measuring. So we've got all the ingredients. We've got historic fire exclusion. We know the history. We have a lack of active management in this area. Extensive acreages of lodgepole pine trees that were consumed by the bark beetle. So we've got a lot of dead standing out there, fuels ready to burn. So we've got contiguous accumulated fuels, and with temperature warming, we will have more drought stress, which is an invitation to more diseases and insects on those individual trees. You're going to be some stress on those, on the vegetation, and that means greater intensity fires, an increase in the size of fires, more smoke, and more severe fire effects. Now we'll look at some recommendations.
Question. Do you want to do it now, or do you like to wait? Do you want to give a question now, or do you want to wait?
Are we through with this panel?
No, there's one more. Their recommendations, and then we'll have questions. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay.
Following the Pole Creek fire, Oregon Health Authority collaborated with Department of Forestry, DEQ, U.S. Forest Service, Oregon OSHA, local health departments, and others to develop an interagency protocol to guide government response to severe wildfire smoke episodes. OHA encourages local communities to use this protocol, and I believe you may have that in your information packets, to respond to such events in the future. So after each fire season, the same agencies that created the protocol, plus any additional agencies that want to be involved, gather to update and refine the protocol based on recent experience. I believe this protocol sprang out of the Pole Creek fire incident. I mentioned earlier our difficulties in obtaining emergency department data. We have been able to make some progress since that time. As I mentioned, there's no requirement to for emergency departments to provide Oregon Health Authority with this type of information. Oregon Essence is an automated electronic data reporting system that's now available. If all hospitals use Essence, the kind of information that OHA needed would have been readily available without placing any additional burden on hospitals because it is an automated system. This would have allowed Oregon Health Authority to track the emergency department visit information and would have given us a better opportunity to respond to the public health effects of the wildfire. So our request here is simply to continue to encourage all hospitals in Oregon to implement the Oregon Essence system so that we can improve this timely reporting of emergency department visits across the state.
A couple more slides here, and on now for Department of Forestry's recommendations. And Teresa's last slide was intended to try to really reflect for you all the recipe that exists out there, and what that creates when you have lands that aren't actively managed. Unfortunately, there's millions of acres of national forest land in Oregon that we see now that will result in greater intensity fires, increase in the size of fires, more smoke, et cetera, due to that lack of active management. So our recommendations really attempt to address this at a landscape level. The first one relates to supporting the cohesive wildfire strategy. The cohesive strategy is a national effort in response to requirements of the Federal Land Management Assistance, Management, and Enhancement Act, better known as the FLAME Act of 2009. The Wild Land Fire Leadership Council directed the development of the cohesive strategy. Essentially, the cohesive strategy, bottom line, it's a framework for collaboration, and it involves really all levels of government, nonprofits, as well as the public. It seeks national, all lands, basically all hands approach to providing solutions to wildland fire management. The cohesive strategy is focused on three goals, where all the hands work together to find really that sweet spot when working in all three of these areas, whether it's creating fire-adapted communities, and essentially what we're talking about there are communities that are developing their community wildfire protection plans as an example, restoring ecosystem health. In ODF, we call that active management. And lastly, implementing safe, effective wildfire management decisions. I think you all recognize for us that's very straightforward in terms of our objective of aggressively fighting fires, keeping them at the smallest possible size, and minimizing really acres burned, costs, and loss. ODF has one of the first funded pilot projects in Northeast Oregon. It's called the Blue Mountain Pilot. And we are actively seeking other funding to apply this work further elsewhere in the state. Not going to touch specifically on these two bullets here, but simply put, I think our call is really for an increase in active management on federal forests proactively before a fire starts, as well as after with salvage and restoration work. The risk of fire occurrence and fire severity increases substantially if salvage and other fuel reduction actions are not implemented in a timely manner, ultimately transferring risks to adjacent landowners. And in Oregon, oftentimes those other landowners are private landowners that we're providing protection for. There's obviously a lot we could talk about here. I also know that the legislature has been engaged on many fronts on the topic of federal forest management, really all towards trying to keep Oregon's forests green and working. The department and OHA are committed to utilizing this report. As you recall at the beginning, the essence of this report was really about increasing public awareness, and I hope that you've also found really the fact sheet along with our report. We will have sometime this afternoon, if not already, an initial news release, and we're working closely with Representative Wisnett on some other thinking about where and how we can roll this out in terms of increasing the public's awareness. Lastly, we would like to make some acknowledgments of people that were instrumental in the production of this report, and you can see that here on the screen. So with that, I'd just say thank you, and we'd be happy to take any questions.
No questions. Doug?
Thank you, Chair. For Ms. Alcock, when I was fighting fire, perhaps the most salient part of the wildlife was those that were incinerated. I don't think you already mentioned that. A couple of questions. I didn't hear or see anywhere in this report any computation of the value of the habitat resources lost. I'm sort of appalled that we don't have a dollar figure, or at least an estimate on that. And secondly, are you familiar with the Hinkle Creek studies that sort of refute what you're talking about with fish habitat and the loss of canopy?
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that, but I'd be happy to research it and take a look.
That was I believe that was done by the Department of Forestry, wasn't it?
The one that's outside of Sutherland?
Yeah.
Us working with Oregon State University.
Chair Roblin and Senator Woods, I would like to address the question on kind of the economic piece I think you were highlighting. This legislation was very specific in its request and asked only for the effects on public health as well as the effects on habitat. But I assure you that we know and we've communicated in many fronts on the topic of the economic, you know, costs and specifically the losses that result from fires of any size, but ultimately large fires.
If I may respond, that's a very sensitive issue with me because rarely do we see that that information in any media. We see the cost of suppression, and we see the cost of the loss of structures. And if there's loss of life, unfortunately, that's brought into the account also. But the loss of the cost of the habitat, fish habitat, the loss of resources is never mentioned. And I think that's a major oversight. The other line of questioning was for the health authority. We have five cities. There's towns in Klamath Falls that are under severe regulations for air quality. Three of those I represent, and I've never been in one of those towns during the time that they had a red day that you didn't have virtually unlimited visibility. Yet in the Pole Creek fire, and also with the, I'm more familiar with the Berry Point fire, we had visibility down to sometimes in town in Lakeview you couldn't see across the street as it was in Sisters. And yet you're not able to find any adverse health benefits from that. So there seems to be, to me, it'd be a complete dichotomy in which you're regulating some people out of business and other people you can't find a problem. And whether you want to respond to that now or whether you'd like to make an appointment, we could talk about it in my office. But, I mean, there's a dichotomy there. It makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Chair Roblin, Senator Witt said, I can make an initial attempt and would offer to follow up with you later for a fuller answer. But I do know with the data that we have and the unfortunately the small numbers of cases that we have, it does become difficult to state conclusively. But we will follow up with you on that question.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Teresa? So, you know, I mean, we just seen a couple pictures, and obviously there were some parts of this fire that burned pretty severe, especially when they're burning up those, the older growth or pine that are really armored up and supposedly fire resistant, weren't so fire resistant. But would you agree that since, you know, when those fires burn that hot, any of the habitat that has the ability to leave, leaves, unless they get trapped? And they won't come back until the conditions change to bring them back, which could take, if it's deer or elk, whatever, it could take a couple seasons for grasses to come. So it may be a couple years for them to come back and everything. Well, wouldn't you agree that if we were going to do any salvaging, that we'd want to do it right away before the forest started to recover, so we're done with that process? Would you agree with that?
Chair Roblin, Senator, yes, I would agree.
And wouldn't that, you know, our late successional reserves, they're set aside for a reason. But like I said, if everything leaves, if we're going to do any salvaging on the late successional reserves, it should be right away. So the critters can come back a couple years from now when things attracted them to come back. Wouldn't you say that that would be the responsible way to look at it?
Sir, I would agree, and there is a short window of opportunity for that activity.
Okay. Another question for the health authority, and I forgot your name.
Curtis Coots.
Okay. Sorry about that. Is there any studies out there on the accumulative effect of wildland smoke? I'm kind of concerned about that.
Exactly.
Is there any studies out there on that?
Chair Roblin, Senator Barschlinger, I'd like to introduce Dr. David Ferrer, our public health toxicologist. He'll try to answer that question for
Great.
Us.
Great.
Calling in the lifeline.
That's right. Exactly.
So
Chair Roblin and Senator Barshiger. I'm David Fair, a toxicologist with the Oregon Health Authority. Essentially, a lot of components of the wildfire smoke can cause cancer if you have long enough exposure to them. The problem, the thing is that usually a wildfire doesn't last long enough to really increase that risk. A single wildfire doesn't. So
I'm in trouble.
So it would have to be accumulation over over a long time for it to make a difference in the years. So it's a single fire.
What's a long time?
We sort of think about it in terms of 7 years. Like it's got to be like 7 years worth of exposure before you.
You're toast.
and it also doesn't mean that, you know, we talk about cancer in terms of risk. So it's not like a definite that you will get cancer. Although the background rate for us is, you know, one in two men will get cancer at some time in their life, even without fires. But, yeah.
Okay. Well, I know I will tell you that the older I get, the less I like it. I don't know if that's because I'm getting wiser or if something's going on. Okay.
So,
but there are no real studies over the cumulative effects.
Not specifically for fires, but there are for several of the components of wildfire smoke. A lot of the same things are in automobile exhaust. So, so that's for most people, sort of the risk that comes from exposure to road exhaust basically sort of overshadows the risk that you get from wildfire smoke because it's periodic and not as consistent.
Okay, thank you.
So do we take stock in the amount of materials that are carcinogens and whatever that come out of these fires that could result in being a part of the environment for times to come? When you're downstream, I mean, if you're downstream of a downwind of a smelter, people keep track of that kind of stuff and let people know that this is not, the ground here is not real great if it was an old smelter. Today we do a lot more stuff. So, and there's mercury and a bunch of other things. I mean, you mentioned that there are a number of carcinogens. Do we do have a list of those kinds of things so that public knows what's happening when?
Yeah, and in fact, the report includes a list of a basic list of the major components of wildfire smoke. As far as amounts, it's pretty difficult to. There are studies that try to do that. That try to like model how much of each of the components comes from a specific fire, but as far as measurements in real time. It's really only the PM2.5 that we're able to measure kind of as we go. And that is the component that's the most, that can cause the most acute health problems, like the increased risk of heart events and respiratory illness.
Okay. Yes, Senator Close to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David, I'm just interested. You talked about the Oregon Essence program where you're tracking emergency room visits. So after a fire, if someone comes, people come, are there certain toxicology tests that they're running on fire specifically?
No, I think it would be, we would be looking for specific types of presentations like respiratory-related illness or heart-related illness, those illnesses that have been shown to be related to air quality. So we wouldn't be looking specifically for air quality, but more just counting the number of people that come in with a heart problem or a respiratory illness.
Okay, thank you.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fair, if I understood your testimony, you said that the concentration of 2.5 parts per million particles are really not as relevant as the length of exposure to them. Yet you can inhale, in as Senator Barshiger could agree, you can inhale as much smoke in two or three days in a fire, for that matter, in 30 minutes in a fire as you would in Klamath Falls in 10 years. So, can you kind of drill down a little bit on what your thought process is or what the research says, because it is it the constant irritation that causes the problem, or is it the actual concentration of the offending material that causes the problem? What?
Right. So Chair Roblin and Senator Whitsett, the difference. There's two different components cause different types of health problems. So PM 2.5 is more associated with this kind of, especially in a fire situation, is this kind of acute heart events can lead to heart fatalities and respiratory deaths. And
I'm talking about the effects on the lungs. I mean, if you breathe in more 2.5 part per million material in 3 days in a fire than you would in 10 years in the city, why is it worse? Is it worse in the city and not on the fire? I don't get it.
Oh, right. Well, in a fire, the problem is that it's the lungs don't have time to clear it in between. If you're exposed kind of constantly at a lower level, your body's constantly your lungs are constantly clearing out the particles and getting exposed to more particles at the same time, but your lungs are able to keep up with it to some extent. So it becomes more apparent for people who are older or for people who are starting to be less resilient and less able to clear the particles as quickly as younger people or people with stronger lungs. So that's why you see the problems in cities more often with people in those sensitive groups, actually with everyone in sensitive groups. But I think I hope that's getting to the question you're asking.
Maybe we can talk later.
Sure.
Representative Lissett.
I'd just like to note that down in Klamath on some of the fires, the Biscuit Fire, things tend to drift into the Klamath Basin from areas to the west and also from the east, the Berry Point Fire. And there were times where we were under constant smoke, and I'm sure particulates in exceedance of that, for 1 month continuously, sometimes 2 months in the case of the Biscuit Fire, or 2.5 months where you literally could not see from here to that wall. And yet they don't consider that on our air quality, that the DEQ counts for excessive pollution. And I'm sort of following up with Senator Whitsett there, trying to understand. You said it took 7 years of that kind of exposure to create a problem. Is that what you said of the 2.5?
Chair Roblin and Representative Whitsett, that's a distinction. That's not the PM 2.5. The 7 years is more other components of the smoke that are more directly carcinogenic. Actually, to your point about it should be that the PM 2.5, what you were seeing as smoke, it would count towards the air quality index for the area. It may be that there weren't monitors in place to be able to keep track, but if you have visibility that's reduced to less than a mile, I mean it would certainly be showing up in the air quality index.
Yeah, yeah.
It depends on what monitoring was available and
where
it was.
They don't count that. They only count it from sources outside of forest fires or the burns that we have going around the basin. We get a lot of, they burn on the periphery, and they don't count those days that it's from smoke when they are determining. That's what we've been told down there.
In Sisters, the air quality index was in the was categorized as hazardous specifically because of the fire. So
that's with DEQ, and I mean with which who does that monitoring?
DEQ.
That's DEQ.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll have to check with them.
It seems like it would be worthwhile to do some follow-up.
Yeah, I'll follow up.
What component of the baseline is, you know, how that relates to wood smoke and the wildfire smoke contribution to that.
Yeah, right.
Mr. Chair, yes. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, and then we have one short question from Senator Bear Sugar. Go ahead.
You know, these fires anymore, well, historically even, put, you know, it's a massive carbon release with just tons and tons. Do we have any studies? Do we know how many tons we're putting up per acre? Have we done any studies on that yet?
I can't quote that off the top of my head, but I know we can get you that. There are some new metrics that look at carbon release in the atmosphere from wildfire smoke.
Okay, because yeah. I know there's a group in Seattle that is starting to work on some of the economic effects of fires, not just the cost of the fire, but the cost of habitat, the cost of communities and stuff. And I have that in my office, Doug. If you swing by, I'll get it to you.
If I may, Senator Bearsugar, I'm familiar with some of the economic studies from the University of Washington. That's my alma mater. Mm-hmm. And also from the Pacific Northwest Research Station, the Forest Service in Seattle, has extensive smoke modeling and combustion modeling that they do in their fire behavior group. So it's another point of research that I can look into as well. And just to address you, Senator Whitsitt, we did a pretty extensive wildlife impacts review of the literature to prepare this report. And we've had Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife vet through our science to make sure that it made sense. But there's an incredible amount of research, and I hope I have a chance to address your concerns as we go to make sure that we've covered the bases and looked at all the alternatives. I appreciate it.
And I was just going to try to put a wrap on this discussion and just let you know that I think the implications are pretty clear here, that following the status quo in terms of forest management and maybe fire management on federal lands is going to produce a suite of consequences that we are not ready or willing to accept. I think we all recognize the costs associated with fighting fire and the losses associated with timber damage, the volume damage from fire. The specific purpose of this project and the bill from last session was really to try to find another way to connect with people and talk to folks about what the consequences of these choices, of these policy choices are. So, there's many different doorways that we can walk through, whether it be pushing on salvage or pushing on forest management policy reform or helping the Forest Service to change their business model for the way that they're able to plan sales to be able to operate at a different pace and scale. But until we're able to do that, we're going to see probably more smoke. We're going to see more damage like what we described here today. And our interest is being able to find another way to speak to Oregonians about what those consequences are. And that's really the basis of this work.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and I agree we need as many different ways to talk to as many different constituencies out there so they understand the costs and the loss of value, as we've talked here, to Oregon when we let these fires happen. So thank you very much. I'm going to close the public informational meeting on the impacts of the Polk Creek wildfire, and I'm going to open up an informational meeting on the 2012 large fire review. I guess Doug gets to stay here for this.
I get to stay here. And I'll take this off. All my friends and colleagues join me up here. I'll get started. For the record, again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Beth, my name is Doug Decker, Oregon State Forester, Director of the Department of Forestry. We are pleased to bring back before you an important piece of work that began here with members of this committee last year, and that really grew out of the 2012 fire season, particularly the Berry Point fire outside of Lakeview. Testimony and conversations that began here with this committee and that really grew out of our own after-action reviews have helped us and will continue to help us improve our coordination and our communication and our overall operations on joint jurisdiction fires. So today what we have teed up is that several of us involved in this effort will share with you the report from an external committee that I convened to review large fire operations from the 2012 fire season. It was clear from what we heard here last May and other communications that there was a need to examine these large fires involving multiple agencies to better coordinate and communicate and integrate with our private forest and range owners. And in some cases, we had some successes. In other cases, we had some challenges that we are committed to addressing and improving. It was clear that we needed to ensure that landowner concerns, as well as landowners' local knowledge and their capabilities and resources that they can bring to bear, as well as the value of their property, was clearly communicated throughout the fire organization, particularly to our federal fire partners. And these needs really are at the heart of the work of the Large Fire Review Committee. Increasingly, as we've been talking about here just moments ago, fire suppression in Oregon involves a complex multi-agency mix of fires across ownership boundaries, where different landowners have different objectives for managing their lands that often require different suppression strategies and different jurisdictional responsibilities. And for us at ODF, our mission is pretty clear and pretty simple. It's basically put fire out and minimize the cost, minimize the loss, and work as a partner with landowners in this complete and coordinated system that we share for firefighting response. For other agencies, particularly on their own jurisdictions, the objectives can be different and more complicated, and yet we all operate in the heat of the battle with a shared set of tools and people and expertise. So when we're working in a multi-agency setting, how do we ensure that all of our fire partners recognize and respect the values that are associated with the private land that we protect and the important relationships that we have with those landowners? How do we make sure that our landowners know how to access and communicate about damages that they've experienced, about resources that are available to them after the fire as they work to pick up the pieces? So really, to help us answer these and other questions and to demonstrate our commitment as an agency to continuous improvement, I asked 11 citizens, including several legislators, Senator Whitsitt, Representative Bentz, a county commissioner from Lake County, landowners from across the state, to engage in a deliberate and external review to improve our existing policies and to develop new strategies for the future that will improve our ability to respond to fire, particularly in these multi-jurisdictional events. I provided six key objectives and asked the group for recommendations, and you have a copy of the committee's report back to me, and it has 46 recommendations that are grouped according to four key themes. So this afternoon, what we want to do is provide you with a high-level overview of the work, and I've asked the chair of this committee, Craig Shin, if he would characterize the committee's work and its outcomes to describe the value that the work has. And then following Craig, Chief Operating Officer Michael Jordan will speak specifically to the risk management themes that were included in the report. And then ODF's Fire Division Chief Nancy Hirsch is going to talk about how we have begun to implement the recommendations. So with that, I would ask Craig Shin to walk us through the key themes.
Good afternoon, Chair and Vice Chair and members of the committee, particularly Senate Whitsitt. Good to see you here in this context. He could give this report, I'm sure, as well as I could. I'm pleased to be here. My day job is at the Marco Hatfield School of Government at Portland State, where I coordinate the Environmental and Natural Resource Policy Programs. I also chair the Committee on Family Forest Lands. You know, I said yes when Doug asked me to chair this committee for a couple of reasons. There had been plenty of after-action reviews of and particular fires.
Could you give your name one more time?
Craig Shin.
Thank you.
But this was an opportunity to actually raise our sight line, look across fires, look at the system as a whole, and make recommendations for improvement. We met in December. We had anticipated meeting in the summer of 2013, but the 2013 fire season came earlier with more drama than anticipated, and so we postponed the review committee in favor of fighting fires. We met for 2 days, and I think it's fair to characterize the conversation that we have as frank, open, and constructive. There were a number of outputs from this committee's work. One of them was the conversation itself. The review committee members that you see here were engaged in this conversation, but the room was filled with senior members from the Oregon Department of Forestry and other partners in the coordinated fire response team. And so the conversation that we were having, the key issues as they arose, the recommendations as they emerged, all were heard directly by people who needed to act on them. We collected key points. There are minutes that are copious in nature. And then we fashioned this report. This report takes the 46 recommendations that emerged from this committee and organized them in four themes. The report before you, under each of these themes, provides a summary that gives a sense of the discussion that the committee was engaged in, a sense of the tone of that. The recommendations that are relevant to that theme then follow, and in italics, you can see the initial response by the Oregon Department of Forestry in how they would act on these recommendations. So the first theme is the theme about wildfire policy and landowner risk. And one of the key messages from the review committee was that for the lands that the state of Oregon protects, every acre has value. And the recommendation that comes out of this is that this is a message that ought to be carried forward to partners that we engage in the fire response system. A second message has to do with the kind of thing you've just heard about earlier this afternoon, that the fire-prone conditions, particularly on federal lands, transfer risk to private landowners. And with some 13,000 miles of common border, this is a significant transfer of risk. There is a package of recommendations that you can look at that have to do with improving the incident management team performance. Those are some key recommendations that surround theme A. Theme B is the theme that responds to a whole series of recommendations about communicating and coordinating, particularly with landowners and family forest landowners, the smaller landowners. If you imagine ownership across the land, larger landowners are more likely to be engaged in the Fire Protection Association. They're likely to be connected to the networks of communication. They're more likely to be engaged in coordinated responses. Family forest landowners, somebody owning 100 acres or 1,000 acres or 3,000 acres, might experience a landscape-level fire once in their lifetime. And so the message here is that we need to get connected with landowners, particularly the smaller landowners, before, during, and after these fire events. And that means that there's recommendations that have to do with pre-staging and pre-organizing networks for communication, the possibility of using landowners as network hubs, if you will, to increase communication, perhaps even hiring some landowners as liaisons to improve this kind of pattern of communication. It's also true that the committee found that communication with federal partners, particularly on the ground, has been less than it has been historically, and that we need to do some things to ensure that there's better connectivity close to the ground between folks that have responsibility for federal land management and other landowners. The third theme C, relates to the technical and financial assistance in post-fire events. Again, there's an asymmetry. Small landowners are less likely to have the expertise or the knowledge about what their responsibilities are and what their opportunities are. And so recommendations that come out of this theme include things like perhaps having a kit of information that's available at the time of fires or in immediate post-fire events that would make clear to landowners what some of the opportunities are in terms of and some of their responsibilities in terms of post-fire events. Also, we clearly need to look at the policies and practices that we have in place to optimize incentives and minimize disincentives for responding in post-fire settings, from salvage to reforestation to restoration and repair. And there's a sensitivity that comes out of the committee that the programs need to work on the dry side as well as the east, as well as the west side, and that so we need to look at what some of the ideas are that can allow us to be effective on both sides. The theme D has to do with increasing transparency and clarity of the state's tort claim process. And the recommendations come here in a couple of different categories. One set of recommendations have to do with making the system that we have work and work better. This includes early communication and more often communication with claimants, and doing so in a way that reflects individual responses. And then another set of recommendations come out of conversations about some perhaps different approaches. The state of Montana, for instance, suggested that there are ways in their state for the equivalent of the Oregon Department of Forestry to settle some claims directly. Also, there was a conversation about the possibility of creating some kind of safe harbor agreements that would allow professionals to engage in information conversation that would not put them at risk in later stages of the processes. I've been asked whether this report reflects the views of committee members, and what I would tell you is that there are some committee members who would like some of the summary comments and some of the recommendations to be more strongly worded or more pointedly worded. There's others who would like some of the comments to be smoothed more, reflecting the significant improvements between the 2012 season and the 2013 season. But I think that this report, all the members would agree that it reflects the conversation that we were part of, that it was worthwhile and that there's value. And I think that all the members of this committee would say that it's not the words on the paper that are going to be significant in terms of its value, but the actions that emanate from these recommendations. So I commend the report to you, and I recommend that you look at these 46 recommendations. Some of them have the name of the Oregon legislature on them. Some of them have the Committee on Family Forest Lands name on them. So there's plenty of responsibility to respond to the recommendations that this review committee offers. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Jordan. I'm the state's chief operating officer, and probably more importantly today, I'm the director of the Department of Administrative Services. The reason I'm here today is the recommendations under Theme D, which have to do with the state's risk management processes and how the state responds to tort claim through that risk management division. Mr. Shin already summarized the themes of the recommendations under Theme D. I guess my role here today is to show you that there is a commitment by the Department of Administrative Services to take those recommendations seriously. We are already in motion on recommendations 40 and 41 to do some baselining of kind of our historic approach to these kinds of claims, and then also to try to work with the Department of Forestry on how we can improve communication and outreach prior to the event so that we have some ready-made materials to be able to get to landowners prior to their tort claim notices coming in, because historically, and I know committee members are aware of this, but when a tort claim comes into the department, it puts us instantly into kind of a pre-litigious kind of stance on these things. And that doesn't always lend itself well to wide open communications and complete interactions with the folks who are on the other side of what may be litigation at some point. And so there's a tension to be balanced here, but there is no question, and I will constantly ready to say that we reserve the right to get smarter and do better on these processes. And so we will be looking into also the other five recommendations, which will require a little bit of research, and I am certainly very open to some more discussions with both the department but also with the legislature particularly about recommendations 45 and 46, which have to do with really alternate models on how to treat these kinds of claims, these kinds of damages that occur, quite frankly. The committee is well aware that under Chapter 477 of the statute, there is a fairly high standard for the state's liability in these kinds of cases when it comes to payouts. And so the department is very open to talking about, from a policy perspective, does the state want to take different approaches to these kinds of damages than what has historically been a very litigious kind of atmosphere? And so that doesn't excuse us from trying to be better process monitors and being able to be more communicative to the degree possible with claimants. So we're open to all of those things. Obviously, some complications in some of those. And then lastly, I should have mentioned recommendation 46. My understanding is there's already a model that the state legislature has is piloting regarding medical malpractice and a possible intervening mediation kind of approach that might help keep us out of litigation and help us be able to talk through these issues in a different kind of venue that isn't so litigious. And so I'm here basically to say we're open to working on all of these and made a commitment with the Department of Forestry and ultimately with you to work on how we can do better.
Questions?
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
First, I'd like to compliment Mr. Shin on his ability at facilitating. He herded a group of very disparate cats and did it quite well, and we actually got through what we wanted to do. I think it, moving forward, the Department of Forestry is making progress. They have good recommendations. Certainly had a better performance in 2013 than they did in 2012 by all accounts. Looking back, we've done nothing for the people who were injured in 2012. I don't think there's virtually no relief for some of the suppression failures that resulted in severe problems. From the standpoint of the risk management, again, looking forward, I think we're probably looking in the right direction. Mr. Jordan, you need to understand the anger, the rage of many of the landowners in Lake County, and I believe it is well directed. Perhaps you do not have, your risk management does not have the ability to communicate. But you know, as we recall, the first letter was all the first letters to the 12 landowners were all the same. All denials, only they were misworded, so they had to send them again. Then, as a result of the first meeting that we had here, Department of Justice went out to investigate each of the landowners that I've talked with. So that was pretty much pro forma as opposed to in-depth investigation. The second set of letters that went out, Mr. Jordan, were all the same again. They were dated the day before our committee meeting, and when those letters hit in Lake County, my phone melted down because the landowners who had been there, as well as myself, had been led to believe that this was an ongoing investigation when the letters had already been sent, Mr. Chair. And so that is the kind of constituent the word I'm looking for, constituent communications that we should avoid at all costs.
Okay, yeah.
I have a couple questions for Mr. Jordan. How much has the state paid out in tort claims related to wildfires?
Senator Roblin, Mr. Chairman, Representative, what's it? I don't have that number with me right now, but I can certainly try and find it out.
Could you find out for the last 10 years?
10 years.
Would be great. And then the second question is, did the state try and determine who is responsible for the backfires that led to the destruction of the buildings and livestock that were destroyed in the backfires? Did the state figure out if that was
federal firefighting teams or state firefighting teams?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Whitsitt, I don't know the specific answer, but I know that the investigators both talked to particular landowners out there and spoke with the department's staff. I can certainly get you specifics regarding the investigation, but I don't have them at hand.
Okay. Mr. Brzezinski.
Michael, I appreciate the position that DAS is taking as how we might be able to be more collaborative in reaching decisions. I think the model that you're talking about is one of those ones that you can break away from that adversarial perspective. But I think we all know at the same time, whatever we do as a state is not going to be binding on the feds. And let's face it, many of the fires that we're discussing and the impact to private landowners is what actually started on federal lands. And I mean, that is one of those things that I would wish that we could somehow get them to also be willing to sit at the table and be a much better protective participant than what they've demonstrated time and time again. And I commend you from what Senator Whitsitt says as to the work that all of you have done, Mr. Shen, for your leadership. But the reality is, if we don't have everyone, the major players at the table, you know, we may be just misleading people to a belief that something's going to happen that we have no control over unless we're going to take on the obligations of the federal side.
And I guess from my perspective, if there are legislative recommendations in the group, Doug, and I would love to see us get together to start crafting the kinds legislation we need for the 15 solutions that would help implement these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And we'll work with Beth or whoever we need to, but we'd love to have your lead in helping us kind of start crafting some of that kind of stuff. And
can I have one more question?
Yeah.
Mr. Jordan, is it possible to get the the results of the individual investigations by the Department of Justice on this fire, on the Berry Point fire? The raw material, unedited, and what they actually found, who they talked to, and what was discussed.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitsitt, I'll speak with the Department of Justice about how that can be released.
Thank you.
Ben.
And I think we left out one of our participants.
Yes, we did leave out a presenter.
So.
No, I think we'll maybe Nancy could touch on where do we go from here. How have we implemented and how will we implement these recommendations? Depending on time, I may come back with just a couple of closing messages. Okay. Nancy, do you want to touch on that?
Sure. Well, good afternoon again, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Hirsch, Oregon Department of Forestry Fire Protection Division Chief, and appreciate having the opportunity to touch on what I would like to touch on, which is really about implementation. The recommendations, as were mentioned, there was a number of those, and really the recommendations, just to highlight this slide, are focused on improving what we all know as the Oregon State complete and coordinated fire protection system. And so what we're looking at are not only policies and processes where perhaps we can make some improvements, but where necessary, actually implementing new ones, which these folks have already touched on. I guess the other thing for me, this is really the important piece for me. It's where the rubber meets the road. It's where change is made, you know, on the front line, up and through the ranks. And, you know, what I hope that you hear, and that perhaps you've heard already, is that we did hear the landowner concerns out of the 2012 fire season. As a result of that, prior to the 2013 fire season, for the first time within our department, I initiated a preseason fire season memo that essentially outlined really my expectations, also highlighted lessons learned, and really specifically how were we going to apply those. They really fell into four key areas. So what I'm talking about here is what did we learn and how was it applied in 2013? The first one, many folks have touched on, is really the importance of preseason communication. And I think I would share for my counterparts, at least the folks I'm working with, not only did ODF hear you, I know that my counterpart at the Forest Service heard you, as well as in Doug's communication up and through the regional forester. Essentially, I would describe it as a full court press because I'm a basketball player and I know that term. A full court press is from the fall through the winter to through the spring. We were in constant communication, communicating these key points that have been described here. Every acre has value. I wish I had coined that term myself, and I wish I had had it at the end of, 2012 season. Dan Schaun, the county commissioner in Lake County, coined that. And while we've communicated and said it a lot of different ways, that is about as simple and straightforward as you can get. Every acre has value. And I assure you that our counterparts today that we work with across agencies are understanding that and getting that a whole lot more than they ever have. The second key point focuses really on that expectation of communication, coordination, and integration with our landowners. You know, for us, it's a very natural in the 100-year system that we have. Landowners are our partners. So it's natural that we're working with them. When we get into these joint jurisdictional fires, and really, frankly, whether it's a small fire initial attack or a large fire, the overall fire protection system does rely on a mix of ODF resources, federal resources. So this notion of ensuring that frontline firefighters and folks on interagency incident management teams understand that expectation for early engagement with landowners, ongoing communication, a number of improvement ideas for how to do that and better meet landowners in their community are all things that we'll continue to work on. Wanted to give you one specific example, though, on the 2013 fire season relates to the Douglas Complex. In this case, obviously large fire, multiple fires. On the Rabbit Mountain fire, there were a number of larger landowners that came together. They know the area. They have subject matter expertise. They also happen to have really great equipment, the right kinds of equipment for suppressing fires. They basically formed together in a group and also worked directly with a landowner representative. That landowner representative basically tied in with our incident management teams and all the planning cycles and left those landowners to do really solid work, specifically on the north and northwest flank of the Rabbit Mountain fire, and ultimately really reduced the size of that fire's growth. And it's that those kinds of models that we want to be constantly applying and building upon in other cases, and really to be able to extrapolate that at a local level, pre-season, as well as with our smaller landowners. Third one are key factors that need to be considered and communications made in reaching a decision to order an incident management team. The issue here out of 2012, Barry Point specifically, was the number of transitions that took place with the incident management teams, causing confusion and perhaps less accountability than we would like to see. So in 2013, the process for that, we assured that at the local level when an incident management team was ordered, that there was communication through a more regional, but up and through myself and my federal counterparts. And ultimately thinking about, for us, ODF strived to put ODF teams on every fire. That wasn't possible, given we have three incident management teams and we had a number of large fires. The other piece we employed gets at the fourth element of the thing that I highlighted prior to 2013, and it's this notion of strengthening expectations, clarifying roles, and providing accountability. We have basically a district forester who an incident management team works for. In that process, the district forester also still has to maintain everything going on the district, multiple fires, et cetera, as well as provide oversight for these teams. We've always tried to provide that person with some assistance, but we upgraded the term we called that position. We now call that position the Deputy Agency Administrator, and within our fire world and terminology, that very much codifies to an incident management team IC that that person has as much authority as the agency administrator. And lastly, multiple times this summer, we worked with an interagency team where we kept adapting the delegation of authority again to strengthen and clarify what was expected. So you might have felt a little bit of energy from me on that subject. It was obviously an epic season, but it was very important to me that we did apply and demonstrate that we could do better. So how do we move forward? We continue doing this work. Communication, coordination, we're already in that process. I spent 2 days with my federal counterparts just last week. At the highest level, though, I just want to roll back for a moment. I touched on the cohesive strategy in the previous report and just would mention here that in moving forward with some of the recommendations that focus on federal lands and the challenges or opportunities that we have there, this really is the framework that we collectively, whether it's private landowners, government, non-governmental, this is really where we can get our hook in terms of as well trying to make change on federal lands. Another piece I wanted to highlight is training. You know, one of the best ways we create change is providing the proper training, and we've made actually some huge investments here just recently. We're offering a training that's focused on this liaison officer position. It's the position that's critical with these incident management teams in doing outreach with all of our cooperators and specifically with landowners. This year, ODF is offering that, and we're offering specifically a focus on how we expect people to work with landowners. A second one is within our department, as with any organization, we're always trying to manage for change in terms of succession management. This year we're offering specific training for our district foresters. As you know, sometimes they too go into retirement. And so we have some younger or less years in service as the district forester, and we're going to be delivering this, and it's really based upon a policy document that formed right out of the 2012 challenges that we had, and it's called Incident Management Team Management, developed by some real solid leadership, experienced leadership in our agency, and delivering this, I think, will really arm folks to deliver in the case they in the event they have a large fire. A couple other items have already been mentioned. Very interested in, and have already spoke to my counterpart in Montana on this notion of perhaps a different model in terms of dealing with tort claims processes. We had a great presentation at the large fire committee review out of our private forest division, the folks that work very closely with landowners, and they have put together a specific action plan to really get at that pre, during, post-fire assistance. So lastly, on policy, the state of Oregon's complete and coordinated fire protection system is spelled out in Oregon Revised Statute, as you all well know, and has worked quite well. It reflects the partnership that the state and ODF has with landowners. It has proven to be successful, and it has continued to improve and adapt where needed for over 100 years. I hope that you see in me and know from me that me and my staff are committed to that, and we always know that we can do better together. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Nancy. I guess I would just close by emphasizing the federal piece. We started out our time with you here today talking about the Pole Creek report. We talked about the consequences from fires like that. I think from the state standpoint, being able to really emphasize the need to change the way these lands are managed, that's the way to kind of change the long-term arc of the of this impact. We have worked directly, Nancy, with her counterpart, me, with a regional forester, and all the way through the organization to make sure and really sensitize the Forest Service to this message. If you don't remember anything from today, remember every acre has value. That is a key statement that we're making. I would like to just make a tip of my hat to the private forest, the large landowner community. Several of the folks are here today. They've gone out of their way to carry this message forward as well. And so part of what we're working with our federal counterparts is, to some extent, maybe some culture change and some clearly education about fire policy. So when you come to the state of Oregon and you're coming from another region, and maybe you don't know the lay of the land, you are going to get a very clear message and a clear expectation delivered to you as a federal incident management team that every acre has value. In fact, just to, you know, Mike Dykesel in the back of the room, Mike's put together, and his number of his colleagues have put together a spreadsheet that shows what the acre, the dollar value per acre is in Eastern Oregon and Western Oregon, and that's something that he has personally delivered to the incident management team, to the incident commanders. So, you know, to echo Nancy's comment, you know, whether it be at the incident management team level, whether it be on the ground with capacity and training, whether it be at the policy level with forest management policy and trying to focus on active management, we recognize that that is a very important flank to this discussion. So I just wanted to really emphasize that piece. Maybe I've just closed by saying I would like to acknowledge the work that that Craig has done and all of the members of the review committee who gave us their time. I had a chance to exchange messages last night with John Albertson, a rancher from the Lakeview area, who told me that he hoped that he had helped to start a positive conversation here. And I responded that I think he has. And having those voices kind of to get us moving, and this team of folks who helped us develop these recommendations, you know, I think we're going a good direction here. So I think we'd welcome any further comments or questions that you have for us.
Okay. A few last comments.
Thank you. Just one question. I think moving forward, you're doing great. Specifically, what have you done and what are you going to do for the 12 landowners in the Berry Point Fire?
Chair Roblin, Senator Whissett, there is a suite of things that we have done relative to helping to pick up the pieces. We've been working with the Farm Services Administration to make federal grants available. We've provided, even before the smoke cleared at Berry Point, we were our stewardship foresters who provide technical assistance were out reaching out to a number of those landowners. I know certainly from the risk management side, our ability to address those needs and concerns, you know, are constrained as Michael has described. But it's very important to us that we support the landowners with understanding about what the Forest Practices Act requires and doesn't require, as well as providing access to whatever financial assistance is there. One of the ideas that I've intrigued with that you and I talked about when we were in Bend was this notion of creating a emergency response fund that can help landowners in situations like this to pick up the pieces, not necessarily from a tort or a liability standpoint, but from a get some basic restoration and recovery from fire. I think that's one of those elements that's a recommendation that we would very much like to go forward with.
Thank you.
You're part of a collaborative effort, is that right, with the U.S. Forest Service and Nature Conservancy on a piece of land out that was partially consumed by the Berry Point Fire, is that right?
Chair Roblin, Representative Whitsitt, there is a forest collaborative group of a variety of different interests that are associated with federal lands in that area. And so that's a group that meets to try to identify projects that the Forest Service can move forward with.
So you're not part of?
We're not directly part of the collaborative. The state of Oregon has stepped up to try to provide some funding to make available to collaboratives to help them to be able to develop projects. But we're not we're not a landowner partner of that collaborative.
I was just wondering what results you had or they had that you've seen on the burned out part of the Berry Point in the collaborative. Were they able to sell their timber and, you know, rehabilitate it, or do you know yet?
Chair Roblin, Representative Whitsitt, I think there's a pretty stark contrast, as you know and as you've seen, you know, between what has happened on federal ownership as well as on private ownership, and the credit of the Collins Pine folks in Lakeview, they've virtually completed their salvage effort there. I think on the federal side, I don't know that they've actually, and I think actually the market value of that material, the standing is fairly limited at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
And I want to say one thing before I let Senator Boettcher go, but and then we have one little piece of business after that. The testimony in front of the committee from the landowners last time was one of those, I don't know if I go to life-altering, close, life-altering experiences for me, and I think other people on this committee. People who almost got killed by backfires being set on them and family members not knowing where each other were, to a family that fought a fire to the end and thought they had it solved, and then they leave for a little day, and then the backfire cleans out what they had. I am pleased to see that we're moving forward and doing the other kinds of things, but I will tell you that was it was a low point for me with regard to fire suppression in Oregon when I heard those stories from those people. And it continues to haunt me a little bit to think it was the fact we didn't lose the life is really good, but for a lot of those people, they lost their future that they had anticipated having, and some of them didn't need to. I still believe in my own heart they didn't need to lose some of that, but that's I just have to say that. But I do appreciate, I am very pleased that we're moving forward and doing this stuff.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Doug, I'm going to say something you and I have talked about lots of times. I just want to make sure it's on the record for this hearing. And that is we're finally hearing the conversation that Forest Health and extreme wildfire behavior, they go together.
Absolutely.
And extreme wildland fire makes bigger fires. And we're finally getting that conversation that there is a direct relationship with those two things. And I appreciate that. I've been trying to get that out there for years.
Good.
So I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're going to close our informational hearing on the 2012 Large Fire Review, and I appreciate all of your work. And you. Senator Close.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended in order that Senator Burdick and Senator Bertschinger might be able to vote on House Bill 4029A.
Senator Close moves that we suspend the rules so that Senator Bertschinger and Senator Burdick may be able to vote on House Bill 4029A. Is there any objection? Yeah. seeing none, the rules are suspended. Senator Burdick, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Senator Burdick votes aye. Senator Bertschinger, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
He votes aye. So we will. Wait. I think I had to open a work session on Senate Bill. Yeah, let me go back to that one. After you suspend the rules, I'll open the work session on Senate Bill 4029A. Now, how do you vote, Senator?
She still votes aye.
And Senator...
I still vote yes.
He still votes yes. So we'll close that work session. I want to thank everybody, the committee. You've been really here working hard with us. Thank you for coming and joining us today. But I really do appreciate the work of this committee. And our work is done. We may have some issues. I don't think we have anything scheduled for Wednesday.
For Thursday.
So we're off Thursday. And if we have anything else and we're still here the following week, we'll get together. But I think most of it will be.
We'll let you know.
Watch yourself.
So with that, we're going to close our Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development. Thank you all.